You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. We've got a great show for you tonight. First, let me introduce my trusty co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right. I had a really awful shift at work today that I ended up going 45 minutes over, and I was in at 5 a.m. and I didn't get a break. So I was really exhausted, and I just woke up from a nap. So sorry if I'm so a little groggy at the moment, folks, as we do this, but I'm slowly drinking some iced coffee that I have to kind of get myself back going. So we'll see how long it takes for me to kind of wake up.
Okay, well, if you need to wake up, Dan, I highly recommend that you check out a goal scored last night at the MLS All-Star Game by one Joseph Martinez. We'll talk about the All-Star Game here at the opening part of the show, folks. The MLS All-Stars get a 1-1 draw that then leads to losing in PKs. If it's an international friendly and it goes 90 minutes to PKs, I'm not sure that we can really count it as a win, even though technically a team has to win. In any case, a very frantic and exciting game, at least in the first 30 minutes for my money. Andre Favilli, who's anticipated to be on loan for Juventus, scores on a pretty open header in the 21st minute. Then just 5 minutes later, Joseph Martinez scores also on a header from, I want to say, at most 2 feet outside of the actual goal line from the Juventus goal after the ball essentially is in a pinball machine around in the box. So Joseph Martinez ties the game up there. We then get a series of subs, as we knew that Tata Martino was going to play every player at least 30 minutes, but nobody was going to get more than 45 minutes. Joseph Martinez subbed out almost immediately after tying the game up. Teams played to a fairly exciting, if you ask me, but evenly played. Second half ends 1-1 after 90 minutes, and then in PKs, Juventus ends up winning it 5-3 off of and the only miss coming from Bradley Wright Phillips, who put it in off the post. Zach Steffen was in goal for the All-Star during the PKs and got a couple really, really good looks at trying to get a save, but unfortunately was not able to repeat the performance he had against Atlanta United in PKs last year in the playoffs. But in any case, Dan, the All-Star game happened. It was relatively exciting. For my money, a decent celebration of the game in hot Atlanta, but probably one that 3 years from now, nobody's ever going to remember. Your thoughts on the All-Star game this year in particular, the standalone crowd of reportedly 72,317 people, and whether or not the All-Star game still matters in 2018.
So the All-Star game still matters because Atlanta made it matter. They've been doing that. It's the early years in that market bump. Everything that happens there is newsworthy, is huge, because this is all their first experiences with all this. So I think it's fair. And it also helps that Atlanta's been good and has really kind of revitalized the market that is Atlanta sports. Because outside of now this year, the Braves, but really outside of the Falcons, Atlanta's just been like a giant hit, in the last 5 years when it comes to sports, and especially once they lost their NHL team, the Thrashers. It was a real hit because the Hawks were awful and they still are. And, you know, you've got the Falcons, who weren't very good then either. The Braves were finally on a downswing after 20 years of being the best team in the NL East. So Atlanta as a sports town has kind of dwindled, and it kind of has that reputation that it always dwindled, but it always shows up when its teams win, every other sports team or sports town does. So I'm not surprised Atlanta showed out for the 72 million. I'll be 100% honest with you, I did not watch a minute of the MLS All-Star game. I watched the full homegrown game, and that was more interesting to me to watch all these young stud players that they have kind of work it out. You know, what they've spent, they spent 2 days in practice, or maybe a day in practice together. All these homegrown kids from games or the weekend spend a day in practice to get thrown out there, go beat Tigres' U20 team. Who Tigres' youth academy isn't something that's to be feared. I'd be really impressed if they went out and destroyed like Manchester United's like U23 team like that. That would be intriguing to me for a homegrown thing. But I was really impressed by a lot of individual performances in the homegrown game, more so than I was the MLS All-Star game. I think the festivities are cool. I think I love seeing guys like I saw Ilya Sanchez and Alexis Lalas on the Weather Channel doing. There's a really funny video that Sporting KC put out, and the whole like the takeout clips were of them just trying to position Ilya in front of the green screen with all the weather stuff on it, and the entire time he's asking, "Wait, you want me to stand here? Moves, you want me to stand here?" And it's just like it's a really good video. Go check it out on Sporting's Twitter. Kind of gives you a glimpse. He's kind of this quiet slash awkward dude, but when you get him to talk about soccer, he's a really passionate guy, which is funny. But so overall, the festivities and everything surrounding the All-Star game was great. I love the homegrown game. I'm always a fan of the gimmicky stuff. I'll move into my thoughts on the All-Star game as a whole. But my problem with the reason why I like MLB's All-Star game is there's like, so Sunday, even though Major League games are still going on Sunday, you have the Young Stars game, which is their equivalent of the homegrown game. Then on Monday, you have the Home Run Derby and the Celebrity Softball game, which is just as good as NBA's Celebrity All-Star game. It's really fun watching like Rob Riggle crush home runs with the softball, and all of a sudden like Bo Jackson's out there running them down. Like, it's a wild show. I really think like a celebrity like futsal match would be absolutely entertaining. Like, get a couple of former pros in there, get a bunch of big name stars, music stars, movie stars.
You could bring in like Steve Nash since he's a soccer fan.
Yeah, and it, like former athletes. I mean, you could do five aside. You could do 7v7s on a half field. And you know, send them out there for 80 minutes. Give them 2 40-minute halves. You know, do a bunch of teams. They can do mass subs and sit out and do water breaks and, you know, and have a ref, make them play by the rules, make them not pick up the ball and run with it like we see in, I don't know, countless media games at halftime across the country. But, you know, like, if they did some little stuff like that, like, I think it'd be cool, like, for a home run derby, I think it'd be really fun to take, like, the guys who you would consider, like, the best ball strikers in the MLS, and then do the volley challenge that they do on Soccer AM. Go check that out on like Facebook or YouTube or something like that. I get stuck in Soccer AM volley challenge like click holes all the time, and it is so entertaining. Go look it up because I'm not going to take the time to explain it. But it's basically you have a giant line of people that throw the ball off of like one of the bounce back nets, and then you've got to volley that into the goal from around the top of the 18. There's a goalkeeper who is trying to stop all of these shots, and it's just this running continuous thing for a minute. And then they have what's the top bins, and they literally put a trash can hanging from the upper corner. And if you get it into the trash can, on a shot, it doubles your point total and stuff like that. And you could do like a 5-team knockout or 14 like knockout tournament thing like that. That would be like MLS's equivalent of the All-Star game. And that is, I mean, that right there would take like, you know, 30 minutes of an event. You know, couple it with a celebrity like futsal or celebrity pickup match and stuff like that. Mic him up, interview him live, just like we did with Brad Guzan. And you know, kind of make a lot more events that lead into the All-Star game itself to kind of build all of that up, because like to just have we had open training and okay, we had this and there was a concert this night, and now it's the All-Star game. It's like, it comes on really fast. And so I think if they wanted to, they could kind of stretch out the festivities just a little bit, and make it more of a celebration of the league and the players and the personalities in the league, instead of celebrating the fact that we're playing Juventus, in a really big stadium, with a lot of people. I think that is where the All-Star game needs to go, and to turn it into a celebration of what the league is and everybody in the league. And I think part of that too can go from, I would love to see East versus West, because the fan vote gets players in who shouldn't be in, and then the coaches and players vote gets people in who who should have been in the vote. And so then we have the other percentage, small percentage of deserving players that are left out of it in general, because a bunch of randos that probably shouldn't have been there got voted in. So I would love to see East versus West and really celebrate the league itself, not just celebrate the fact that we're playing a meaningless game against a big European team. And for now, that's kind of what sells. But I would love to see them move towards that and celebrating the league over celebrating just a one-off game against a big opponent.
I like all of your ideas there, Dan. You know, off of your point of having, you know, like a celebrity game, I'm imagining like the NBA Tonight crew being a futsal team. I think they'd be absolutely terrible, but I totally want to see Shaq and Charles Barkley mic'd up for that and having them play against. I don't even care who they're playing against at that point. So I think that's a good idea. I like your ideas in terms of turning it into an all-star week with a lot of festivities. We've seen that work with Major League Baseball, who obviously have the two nights. The NHL has kind of expanded that depending on the market. You made a really good point early on that, you know, the All-Star Game was relevant and it mattered because Atlanta took it seriously. Oftentimes, you know, the All-Star Game only really matters if one of your play, if a player from a team you like is in it, and or more significantly, if your city, your team is hosting it and how seriously they take it. You know, you saw last year with it being the MLS All-Stars taking on, you know, Real Madrid at Soldier Field. It was not a stadium owned or operated by an existing MLS team, and obviously, anytime you have Real Madrid play anybody inside the lower 48, you know, it's pretty obvious, you know, who the main appeal draw is, and, you know, the significance of that. Granted, that was still with Ronaldo, and no Ronaldo for Juventus this All-Star game. But, you know, Atlanta took it seriously, and the fans took it seriously, and they made it about Atlanta, about the Atlanta United players, and overall about MLS, rather than about Juventus or a singular player, I guess, other than Joseph Martinez. But at this point, for me, Dan, I think he's going to shatter the record set by Bradley Wright Phillips, somebody else who I can't remember, and Chris Wondolowski. So I think that's deserved. So it was well put on by Atlanta, but at the same time, you know, if we randomly throw it to, I don't want to disparage any other teams in MLS, but, you know, we've been bagging on Colorado and San Jose because we can, because we cover those teams. So I'll use those two for an example. Whereas if the Rapids are hosting this, then maybe it doesn't quite have the buzz in the city, and maybe it doesn't necessarily have that much of a spectacle appeal over the course of a week or over the course of a night, in the context of the greater MLS market or the casual soccer fan who might have been passing, you know, might have passively watched this on ESPN. I'd like to see a change to the structure to the All-Star Game eventually, Dan. I'm pretty much over a lot of these international friendlies. You know, Jose Mourinho's comments from the, you know, the International Champions Cup, whatever it is, essentially saying that this tournament's a farce. All my important players are resting up for the club season. I don't know why we're doing this other than making money. Like, he might as well have flipped off the Glazers and then mooned the TV screens that were showing, you know, this on FS1 after Man U played Liverpool at the Big House up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I'm kind of over that. You know, I'd be open to going back to an East-West, as you mentioned. You know, the fan vote in a lot of ways is a farce or just a popularity contest, and you snub out a lot of players that are relevant as the league continues to grow. And if you've only got one MLS All-Star team, you know, you're limited to 23, 24 players. And if there's one team, be it an Atlanta, a Seattle, or somebody who by the fan vote is able to get two or three players, you're essentially saying that nobody from any other, you know, that's three or four other teams that essentially aren't going to get an all-star. So how do you marry that, you know, whereas opposed to at least with every single other version of an all-star game, you have two teams, you know, from an East and a West, you know, an AFC and an NFC, a National League and an American League, to where the roster is big enough to where you can usually fit at least one guy on every single team, no matter how bad that team is. So I'd be open to that. I know people have dabbled, and I've been a fan of the idea of doing a Liga MX versus MLS Best 11, you know, with the scheduling of where Liga MX would be in their preseason. How would you fit that in? And then how would Liga MX go about sorting out their team? And then do you always have an MLS? Do you potentially have them go down to, you know, Mexico for a game? There'd be some logistics that would have to be worked out in that I'd like to see. But, you know, I think these are all ideas I think worth exploring. And I think at some point, the MLS is going to be taken seriously as an independent league. It has to stop being, let's just go for a big cash grab by getting a big name that even the most casual soccer fan in America is going to like. Dan, let's move on away from All-Star talk. Speaking of the league expanding, FC Cincinnati will be joining the league in 2019, folks, and they've already started to build their MLS roster. Dan, as you were getting some sniffs of on Sunday night, and as it's ultimately been reported over the course of the past couple days, Fernando Adi, who we knew was going to be out with the Portland Timbers, scoring a game winner for Portland over the weekend, is headed to Cincinnati for, depending on, you know, the performance incentives, up to $1 million in GAM and TAM in total. And then Fatai Alashe from the San Jose Earthquakes, who obviously is not in Mikhail Stare's doghouse, will also be heading there as well. There's been some rumblings, at least from my side, Dan, on some of the more USL purists saying that, you know, this is potentially tainting the integrity of competition in the USL. Adi and Alashe will join FC Cincinnati and will play out the remainder of the USL season. Adi won't be going on loan anywhere in MLS Eastern Conference or wherever. But Dan, ultimately, Adi was acquired with assets that FC Cincinnati has the right to. Technically, Don Garber bucks that they won't be getting until January 1st of 2019, but that's neither here nor there. It's promised, it's allocated, but it's money that they only have because they're going to be an MLS expansion team next year. And it's money that only they have and no other USL team has. And pending some drastic change in the MLS expansion landscape, it's money that no team is going to get before August 8th when the MLS transfer window closes for good for the remainder of the calendar year. So I made the mistake, unfortunately, of poking the bear that is FC Cincinnati Twitter, Dan. I don't know how much you've dabbled in USL, but I'm kind of starting to believe that at least at the USL level, they're the equivalent of Atlanta in terms of that Twitterverse. And people coming after me about that when I was questioning the sanctity of it, of saying, you know, like, oh, well, you know, LA Galaxy could loan down players on a weekly basis to Los Dos. And my response is, okay, you getting Hugo Arellano for a game against, you know, Reno is not the exact same thing as Zlatan Ibrahimovic going down. You know, when the Philadelphia Union sent David Akam to a game, to a Bethlehem Steel game, come call me. And furthermore, that, you know, every single USL team has the right to an MLS affiliation, and even if they have an MLS affiliate, they can get loanees from elsewhere as well, and they can loan within the league, and you can, as an MLS team, you can loan to your affiliate, and you can loan to other teams within the USL. Everybody has access to that. You know, Jeff Bezos could cash out on Amazon right now and go and buy the Colorado Springs Switchbacks and say, I'm going to pour $1 billion into this team. Dan, in their coffers under the ledger mark that says 2019 general MLS general allocation money, that number's still going to say $0.00. So is the TAM one. And I don't think Adi is taking this deal and accepting going to a USL team if it's not with the anticipation that he's going to be playing in MLS next year. Your thoughts in general on this move, FC Cincinnati, and then potentially, you know, spending a little bit of money since Adi will be making about $2 million in 2019. Am I completely crazy? You know, the FC Cincy people right in calling me a USL snowflake.
So I understand the questions of the integrity of the move, but the problem is that the paper and the mechanism and the salary and all that does not, and how it all looks on paper, is not illegal. And that's the number one thing that we all have to look at, is that there is, it's part of, I think, a side that we're starting to see more in MLS. You saw it with Nagby, you saw it with Dom Dwyer. Now we've seen it, potentially with, Justin Miram, Sasha Kljestan, and all these guys, that are significant players. But are on their way out, maybe forced out, even Dax McCarty as well, for the allocation money. And the whole thing that this is boiling down to for me is that it is a business. This is something that we hear all the time in MLB, NFL, NBA, in the major leagues, that have a lot of the money, where a lot of these things happen, where there's these borderline ruthless things, that owners and GMs do, because they can, and because on paper, while the integrity of it may not be the greatest, on paper they're allowed to do it, and it helps them. FC Cincinnati is, as far as I'm concerned, is only looking out for themselves. And while they probably would not have got the deal done, with the with the with the with the thought of FC Cincinnati not being in MLS next year. They wouldn't have gotten these deals done, obviously. Fatai Lasha is not going to accept a downgrade unless he knows he's going to be back in MLS. Because I don't know if he ever accepted a real assignment to Reno outside of injury rehab. And I don't know if he was ever given one, so don't try and draw conclusions there. Listeners. But I'm saying, like, Adi obviously would have never gone to the USL. He's a designated player salary. But here's the thing, is the owners are willing to pay for these salaries out of their pocket to deal with this and to make the ways for this to happen okay. This and fit under the salary cap. They're willing to do what it takes to put these players in their team now and get them a chance to be in the city and build with the head coach and with multiple with what it seems like a few other players. There's another player that was announced that they did the same kind of a thing, but he's coming from AC Milan, which is huge. Milan, the name escapes me. But another player, so Cincinnati has made three signings that have now are coming over as a loan, and then when they have the funds, will be bought in January, and when the new league year starts, that brings in Cincinnati as a franchise. I have no problem with owners doing things that they need to do to win. And if it means getting rid of, if it means doing their best to circumvent the rule and find the loopholes and make it all work on paper, because in reality, the league doesn't look at the paper and say, there may be bad integrity behind this. The league just says, hey, this is allowed to happen through our player acquisition mechanisms. It's going to happen now. And so for me, that's where, like we can sit there, we can lament the integrity of the move all we want, but in reality, the business of the move and the practice of it was done within the parameters that were set out that have been set out by the league. Obviously, USL has to approve it. And clearly, it looks like it has been. So USL is okay with this happening because it probably draws more money and more attention to them in all this, which is kind of the up and coming league kind of sellout for whatever gives them some good attention type thing. So the integrity level, I have no problem with the moves. I really like them. I really like Fatai Lasha getting a fresh breath of air and a chance to really gain some momentum and some form and some playing time. I like Fernando Adi leaving. I thought he kind of got phased out with Savarese's system. He hasn't been at his best recently. He's had a whole lot of attitude issues, and the attitude issues have just kind of been there for Portland over the last few years. But since Porter left, and he's kind of out of the Portland system was. Sam Armentrout has been really, really good for them up top. So I think you look at all of that, and this team itself looks like that Portland team is okay without Adi, and that once they hit the point where we're okay without Adi, it made sense that he was going to head elsewhere and kind of get another change of scenery type thing. And I think it's a good way to do it and get them some playing time as well. Because a change of scenery to another potentially volatile situation like Montreal has been, it seems, with the whole Jimmy Briand thing that went down and how that went. But in place, it's kind of a very fluid. I'll take back volatile, but it's a very fluid situation in Montreal, and that was believed to be the number one MLS destination for him, just due to happenstance of the Briand thing falling through, and then there was the potential that he could be loaned back to MLS, but that's not happening. So I think you can debate the integrity and the intent behind it, but we can't debate the legality of the move, and that's kind of the end game for me on it. But yeah, I like the move for both players. I really like the move for FC Cincinnati. That's been one thing that I've struggled. On integrity, I wish Sacramento had been given a shot to be in the league by now, considering that Don Garber said that it was not a matter of if, but when, about four years ago, Garber said that, and still, they've brought in 6 teams now, not named Sacramento. So But my problem with Sacramento has been the fact that they don't seem willing to put up, go beyond the call when it comes to their money. They won't put in extra capital. And to see FC Cincinnati do this and go out and get two big players now, and potentially three with the signing of AC Milan. They have one designated player now, and they have a whole lot of other things that they have that they can still do in the coming months to secure their roster for next season. That really excites me about the situation within the ownership of FC Cincinnati, is that they're really willing to shell out the money to make things happen in Cincinnati, and that is always encouraging, and I think that's a just significant reason why FC Cincinnati was chosen over Sacramento, because I do think that next spot was just between those two, because I don't think the league buys Detroit. So FC Cincinnati and Sacramento were buying for that, and clearly the FC Cincinnati ownership group has been willing to put up the capital that Sacramento hasn't, and that's showing in the player acquisitions, that's showing in their stadium deal, that's showing in a whole lot of things. That, to me, is a good sign, because now we're at a point where we can be picky and choosy with what markets come in. And if they're not going to have viable ownership groups and good capital investment into the team from the ownership groups, then it's not a good reason for a league to pull to allow that team to come in. So it's nice to see FC Cincinnati putting their money where their mouth is here. That's my take on it.
One last question for you, Dan, before I take the talking stick away. Where do you see Alache rating in terms of on an MLS expansion team in the Eastern Conference? You know, he's kind of bounced around positionally and in and out of the starting 11 for the Quakes the last couple years. You know, is he a center mid? Is he somewhere else? You know, and is it the fresh start of, oh, we'll get him and see if he's a bench player? Or do you think he's got a legitimate shot to maybe work himself into being a starter for 2019?
I think he could definitely work himself into being a starter for 2019. I mean, he was almost the rookie of the year in 2015 if it hadn't been for Kyle Larin, Kyle Larin scoring a crap ton of goals. Alache for me is a really, I think he had a really good rookie year, and his development kind of stalled after that. One, because, they brought in Anibal Godoy and a few others, It was 2015 that it was rookie year. But 2015, his rookie year, he did not win rookie of the year. He came in second to somebody who scored a crap ton of goals. I can't remember exactly who it was. So you're looking at that, and he had a solid, really good 2015. 2016, he kind of takes a step back. He has a little bit of an injury issue at the beginning of the year. They had already brought Anibal Godoy into the midfield. And so they kind of had their central midfield hub going, with the setup that, Kinnear had. They kind of pushed him to the outside, and they tried to give him a chance, to kind of take on a more, of a subtler box, moving the ball from the defense to the back line type thing, and then having the roving destroyer D mid underneath him. They tried to make that work out, and it just didn't quite get there. He showed signs of promise, but he never really had the final attacking pass that was necessary. And sometimes he didn't make the right decisions in heading into the final third. A lot of people actually think that he could end up being a really good ball playing center back in the future if he got a lot of time and practice and reps there. But I know he's very particular that he does like his D mid spot. I think it depends on the system the most, and where Alan Cook, the head coach there, deems that, what he decides to put Alache in to be the most successful, because I think he'll be incredibly successful at either spot. I think this time in USL, will give him a really good shot to kind of get his form back and get a good playing rhythm back. Because if you're not playing every day, you're always playing every week, kind of in a bad rhythm, at some point. And you either have to be perfect when you come on, or if you're not, then it doesn't look good when you come on the field, as a sub. So Alache, with more consistent playing time, I think he'll kind of find his stride. And it depends on who else is brought in. I could see him being a really good, like, depth piece in the midfield for them. Or a potential upstart at center back. I mean, he really is only 25, 26 years old. Still got a bunch of years ahead of him to to be good. So I think it'll be a really good move for FC Cincinnati there. It is kind of disappointing how it worked out from the San Jose standpoint. You have the whole flashpoint between him and Mikel Starre. And then I think it was the game against the Sounders last Wednesday. I got a text friend, Colin, who used to cover the Quakes, kind of broke that he was being traded, and then he had packed all his stuff up and was headed out. Reportedly, Tommy Thompson told fans in the parking lot that it was FC Cincinnati. I worked hard to try and figure things out and see if I could get someone to give me a confirmed thing, but it's pretty well kept under wraps by all parties involved until Sunday when it started to leak out through multiple people. So overall, I think Alasha will be fine in Cincinnati. I think at his best, he's a starter. At his worst, he's a really good depth piece for him.
Excellent stuff, Dan. Just a quick fact check, since we couldn't remember the guy you'd mentioned earlier. FC Cincinnati also signed defender Pa Kanote, K-A-N-O-T-E. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly. FF Malmo, product out of Sweden, played for Sweden's U23 team in the Olympic Games most recently, and then most recently has been sitting on the bench for SPAL in Serie A. So he's coming as part of a loan deal that will be through the end of the 2019 season. So he's now with them in USL, and he'll be with them in Major League Soccer in 2019. Hasn't really played a whole lot, so I guess, you know, he needs minutes. Maybe it's a new opportunity, a fresh start for him, but that was the guy you could not remember, Dan. I agree with you on the notion of the integrity, that this is absolutely on the league side. FC Cincinnati obviously was able to sign this player and then loan it from, you know, the semantics of the MLS team to the USL version of FC Cincinnati, and this is completely, if it's within the realm of, you know, what the league is allowing, I'm in no way faulting a team for taking advantage of the resources and the opportunities that are available then. This is absolutely a league problem. You know, if a referee completely botches a call, you know, it's not on on the team to forfeit the game. It's on the official to correct the mistake. So in that sense, it's absolutely on the league to determine whether or not Adi, and I guess by extension here, Alashe, if Alashe was signed with 2019 MLS Garber Bucks, or at the very least go about organizing or thinking about how to handle the situation. I don't necessarily fault the league, given that this is kind of a first time this has really happened, and they don't necessarily know how to handle this because it's never been an issue before. But I'd like to see them address this, or at least have a mechanism for understanding it. You know, if 5 years, 4 years from now, Miami is playing as a USL team and Beckham's ready to start the MLS team. And let's say at that point, MLS has, you know, $100 million in target allocation money, for example. And, you know, that's more, you know, that dwarfs any USL team's budget by multiple orders of magnitude. And then they're able to sign Cristiano Ronaldo off of that in the middle of the summer window and say, oh, we'll just have you play in USL. You know, like, that's not really fair, just given the amount of money. So this is absolutely a league issue, not necessarily on FC Cincinnati, and it's on the league, even if they don't sort it out in this particular situation, to sort it out, at the very least have an understanding of how to handle this situation in the future. That said, I don't know that I see a whole lot of things changing, because imagine now, Dan, how many MLS eyeballs that don't frequent USL on ESPN Plus that are now suddenly going to tune in, A, because FC Cincinnati is an expansion team, B, because they've got a great atmosphere that's going, I think, going to compete easily with the average level atmosphere you have in MLS, and now they have players who they're familiar with, who Adi, obviously, in a new situation, is going to want to go out there and ball out. You know, this is from a money standpoint alone. It would behoove the USL. It would behoove their deal with ESPN Plus. It would behoove FC Cincinnati for Adi to be available and then to get revenue off of people coming to see Adi in person or online. We've talked about this enough, Dan. Let's move on. The Justin Miram saga with Orlando City SC continues. There were rumblings a couple weeks ago that potentially they were shopping him to FC Cincinnati. Reportedly that they're also shopping him around MLS. There's a possibility, Dan, that he could be returning to Columbus Crew and is not going to get, then, or Orlando is not going to get the kind of money that they gave up in order to get Miram this past offseason. So from a Crew perspective, you know, you get almost half of that transfer fee that you got originally to keep, and then you get the exact same player who's going to be excited and hungry and fits in to your system really, really well. All of this in the midst of, I think, Orlando, I think, losing, what, I think it's 12 of 13 or 13 of 14, and the only win in there was a 2-1 win over, you know, Toronto FC at home, which isn't much to write out about. You know, it was a poor end to the Jason Christ era in Orlando, Florida. It's been a poor start to the James O'Connor era. Granted, that's not all his fault. They haven't really done anything in this transfer window, and I'm ready to declare this team dead for the sake of the 2018 season, Dan. And then you, on top of all of that, I don't think the word was actually death threats, but fans wishing harm on Justin Meerham via social media and other platforms. I'm not going to go into actually quoting what may have been said or reportedly, but in any case, the fans are not happy with Justin Meerham. The fans are not happy with the team. They're not happy with the two head coaches they've had this year. Meerham isn't happy, and obviously the team probably isn't going anywhere for the playoffs. Your thoughts on this general situation, and where the heck is Justin Meerham going to be, you know, this time next week when the transfer window closes?
Yeah, great work for Justin Meerham to find a way to get the heck out of there. Clearly, the Orlando situation, it wasn't just Jason Christ. It was all of them. And it was all of the above. It's the current locker room state. It is a whole lot. There's just a giant mess going on down there in Orlando, clearly. If you look at their slide in the standings and their current form, even when they had won six straight, they were probably the least convincing good team in MLS. I think it kind of just shows where there are plenty of issues. They've got a lot of big names down there and they're not working it all out. And I think another thing that was pointed out that I heard I think it was the Atlanta United Orlando game down in Orlando, and they were talking about Justin Meerham and the issues that they were having getting him to replicate his form with Columbus. And I think it was Taylor. I can't remember if it was Taylor Twelman, because I can't remember if it was an ESPN game or not. But it sounded. But they were talking about how that Greg Berhalter, the master tactician that is right now in MLS. The thing that he did to kind of unlock Justin Meerham when he was in Columbus was getting him to play off the back shoulder and cut in and kind of play in the space between the fullback and the center back, and being a very heavy in-cutting, almost an inside forward wide man type thing to get him up there, playing him also in a 4-3-3 where they've been kind of playing as a 4-1-2-1-2 and pinning him up top alongside a Dom Dwyer, or kind of having him as a roamer around Dom Dwyer. I think Berhalter put him in a position to get things done right in Columbus, and I don't think any coaches in Orlando has put him in the best position for him to maximize his skill set. That is what you want as a player. So I don't blame him for seeking a way out. And it is really cool that Columbus is, according to a bunch of sources now, not my sources, but other people's sources, Twelman, and I believe the guy who covers them the Columbus Post, I don't know if it's Columbus Post Dispatch, but whatever the Columbus paper is, the guy who covers them also confirmed it through one of his sources. But it's a good thing for Justin Meerham, and I'm excited he's going back to Columbus, because hopefully he'll be used in the correct way. And I think Columbus's back line is good. They do not have their offense is kind of shaky at times and not as consistent. And I think it'd be really, really interesting to see the addition of Justin Meerham out wide to their current offensive setup and what they've got going, especially with the Giassi's artist there, that has been in form this season. So, good things for Justin. I'm sure as an Orlando fan, I'm frustrated that it didn't work out, but I blame everyone in the organization first before blaming Justin Meerham.
I completely agree with you, Dan. I think Meerham needs ironically, when he was looking for a fresh start to get out of Columbus, I think he needs something else. I think there are a number of teams probably in the Eastern Conference that would probably fit him best right now. And I think going back in Columbus, I think he would just fit right in exactly where he was when he left. And he'd be the one boost that I think Columbus could pull up and would need in order to really cement themselves as a playoff team. Don't think they're getting a supporter shield, because, unless both Joseph Martinez, Miguel Almiron are sold in the next week. I just think Atlanta's going to run away with the Shield, but I think Columbus, similar to last year, is going to be a really tough out in the playoffs, no matter what, with or without Justin Meerum. I think Justin Meerum would just confirm them being, you know, would just make them a slightly more solid team. You know, Orlando's kind of approaching being a toxic atmosphere, Dan. I was trying to come up with an MLS equivalent. I couldn't really. I don't know how much you follow college football, but it's kind of similar to Tennessee football has been the last couple years with running their head coaches, you know, starting with Lane Kiffin out, not being happy with their quarterbacks and just immediately wanting to win now. And anytime something remotely goes south for Tennessee, that's pretty much the anytime they lose to Florida. And for Orlando, it's basically a three-game losing streak. You know, is the immediate approach is just total scorchers. I think it's a fan base that's really, really angry right now, doesn't have a whole lot of patience, isn't able to sort of see the forest through the trees. And I think it's a front office that's kind of reacting in that sense. You know, we talked, you know, when Jason Christ was fired about that decision and what they were looking for. And, you know, based on what I've seen from James O'Connor, I think it's going to take a little bit more time. But with how much money and the type of contracts they have, you know, you're basically committing to, you know, 2 years of getting out of the bad situations with some of those deals before you then start to build upon it. So, you know, I don't, you know, they've got some good pieces. They've got some talented players. The defense is broken. The style of play of, you know, having total chaos, but then also no control over the game whatsoever is not conducive to success. And I, you know, I don't think you can blame, you know, Justin Meerum from, you know, you put a player in a bad situation and then they play poorly, it's not entirely their fault. So I hope Justin Meerum's able to get out there. I'm not really sure what Orlando does at this point to right the ship this season, and it looks like they're looking at, you know, a third straight offseason of rebuilding or severely retooling their team to try and get some semblance of stability and success you know, down in Orlando, Florida. Let's move on to the rapid fire topics here, Dan. We got an extremely cryptic and not in no way detailed press release from the Philadelphia Union earlier this week, folks. As of yesterday, the day of the All-Star game, Ernie Stewart has officially left the club to be the new general manager of the United States men's national team. The Union have reportedly for the last 2 months been, quote, have been looking for and interviewing candidates to take over as their technical director. They have, quote, identified and agreed to terms with our chosen candidate, end quote, and are currently in the process of finalizing the deal. Dan, we've gotten, it's been virtual radio silence on this, which makes me think that it's somebody completely off the map and not somebody in American soccer we would have been familiar with, or potentially, you know, some of the mostly English, you know, technical directors who've come over in the last couple of years, mostly for expansion teams. What do you make of this, and do you have any idea who this person is?
I have no idea who this person is. If I'm going to take a guess, I actually think I wouldn't be shocked if it was Todd Ramos. And I know you said that you don't think that it could be someone from within the U.S. soccer. But Todd Ramos was reportedly in the top five for the San Jose Earthquakes GM job as he was looking to get into that in the middle of the World Cup cycle, by the way, for the U.S. men's national team. And he's still holding that technical director's role with the U.S. men's national team. So I would be really intrigued to see him there. It seems like he's been kind of itching to, like, either give me the coaching job or get me into a club to run, because I think being a technical director of the national team is a kind of, I don't know how well this works with him and Ernie. This is just my speculation. I don't know anything on it, but Todd Ramos, I think, would be a decent hire because he is he does know MLS. He's been around the U.S. soccer setup for a while. But I think what Philadelphia did well was hiring from outside of the U.S. soccer old boys circle. And Ernie Stewart, by coming back to MLS, kind of earned himself the MLS or the U.S. soccer kind of old boys club spot that earned him that – got him that U.S. soccer GM position. Which I don't think is a bad thing either. I kind of like Ernie doing that. But I think for Philly, the ownership group thought outside of the box and going to go get Ernie, as someone who was very successful in European soccer and building teams, and was successful, in multiple teams, in the Dutch Eredivisie, and getting them into European, you know, knockout rounds of European Cups. So I think, you know, they did well thinking outside the box. I actually kind of think that they'll do a good job on the hire. But I think my my logical choice for them probably would have been Todd Ramos, just because he is familiar with MLS, with the setup, and with the U.S. soccer landscape. But, you know, if they want to make an out-of-the-box hire, I'm totally okay with that, too, and I think it would be a good move, depending on who it is. But Todd Ramos is my speculatory person that maybe it hasn't quite been leaked yet by Ramos or either Philly, or they're just pulling a FC Cincinnati and doing a very good job of keeping it under wraps until like the day it's supposed to be announced. So it'll be interesting to see who it is. I love these announcements about announcements, though. It's a real good like new MLS thing. Like, we're announcing that we're announcing someone. It's fun.
Moving on, Bob Bradley, head coach for LAFC, has confirmed as of today that Marc-Anthony Kaye will miss the remainder of the 2018 MLS season. Dan, Marc-Anthony Kaye had to come off for injury last week in El Tráfico after an unfortunate and kind of incident. It appeared to be an incidental collision with Perry Kitchen of the LA Galaxy. He then reported afterwards that it was a serious ankle injury. Bob Bradley was really pissed off in the post-game media scrum, if that wasn't obvious. And then he reported today that officially Marc-Anthony Kaye is expected to have ankle surgery sometime later this week, and that he will be out for 6 months. Obviously, it's August, which means he's out for the remainder of 2018. This is a decent blow to LAFC in the sense that I thought Kaye, you know, hadn't really figured out his role in the system or from a positional standpoint, was a really good, young, exciting player, and I think was going to grow later on in the season. So I think he's losing out on that, and LAFC's losing out on a depth piece, especially since they don't have a whole lot of depth, Dan. But I don't know that it's going to immediately affect their first team a whole lot. Kaye's been decent, but Bob Bradley kind of has a really good problem right now in terms of that front five in the 4-2-3-1, in terms of where everybody's playing. You know, obviously, Adama Diomande comes into the league, and he's scoring in buckets. Marco Urania, even though he didn't score any goals, was getting a couple of assists to start. So who do you start up top? And then obviously Huerta's here. How does he work in the lineup when you've already got Vela and Rossi and, you know, Benny Fellhaber and Lee Wynn, who 3-4 years ago were considered, you know, two of the better, you know, American number 10s in the league. So, you know, from that standpoint, it was kind of already a clogged midfield as it was, and Bob Bradley was having trouble sort of fitting pieces in and getting everybody happy. I'm in no way wishing anything or saying that it's good that, you know, Marc-Anthony Kaye got hurt, but it's, you know, the, if you were going to pick a piece to lose, the young guy who's going to heal easily, who isn't going to be super demanding for playing time, is probably the one that you'd be okay with losing for a period of time for injury or suspension. So I think that Bob Bradley's going to be able to figure this out. I think they've got other issues that are troubling them right now, no less the mental problem that's happening when Zlatan Ibrahimovic is on the field in the final 20 minutes of a game that they're winning. But it's sad for Marc-Anthony Kaye, and hopefully that he gets well soon and has a better 2019 than he did a 2018. Moving on, Dan, Sporting Kansas City has been hunting and hunting and hunting for an attacking piece to round out their overall lineup, and supposedly they're close to something. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it's not a striker. it's really fun. A lot of fans are like, player, and then all of a sudden it's just been defender. Well, they really need defenders because right now their back line has been a mess. It's rumored that Emiliano Amor, one of their loan pieces that they got from Velez Sarsfield in Argentina, is now on his way out. There was interesting comments after Sporting KC's loss to the Houston Dynamo in the U.S. Open Cup. That Peter Vermes said that he felt like some players gave up. He was really mad about that and frustrated, and that the players would find themselves very, very, very far away from getting into the first team. And having your loan cut short is about as far away from the first team as it can get. So he, a very good defender. I thought he showed a lot of promise, but he did not show well in that game, and it did look like at times he just kind of threw up his hands and kind of meh at the point that it was, you know, 3-1 or 2-1 at that point. So overall, not good from him on that. But so Emiliano Amor is out. And that leaves them with Graham Smith, who has 2 appearances in MLS, and the other being Amir Djidic, who has yet to make a full appearance for the first team in competitive play. And so you've got 2 promising young center backs, but guys that are a little far out of the way when it comes to it. Peter Vermes is very set on having 3 center backs of a starter caliber on his roster. Emiliano Amor was that third, but now that he is out, it looks like they are going to be signing Andreu Frontas from Celta de Vigo in Spain. He, Sporting Kansas City, are dipping into their very much loved Barcelona B, Barcelona setup, or slash Barcelona Academy reject pool that they love to dip into. So they are, it's rumored that this one's getting done. Sporting, according to the Kansas City Star out here, the move is going to happen. It's more, it's a matter of when, not if. So Fontas has been intrigued by coming to MLS for a little while. He's the center back. He also can play as a defensive mid. He played through Spain's U21 national team setup and played a lot for both those sides. He's a little tall. He's going to be more like Matt Beiser. He's a very good ball playing center back. He's not your physical giant, you know, aerial prowess person like Ayko Parra would be, and kind of that very physical, do it, athletic, do it all type thing. He's more of that Beiser type, where he's going to time tackles well, he's going to organize and have his positioning right. And he's a really good ball player with his feet, thanks to the Barcelona Academy setup. But he's got 122 appearances in La Liga. He's got between the Europa League, Champions League, and the Club World Cup, he's got 11 appearances there, and actually two of his five career goals have come in those types of competitions. He's a well-seasoned player. He's 28 years old. He's got a whole lot of experience in his career. I think it'd be a really good move for Sporting Kansas City as they look to shore up the back line. If Ayko Parra struggles on the field to continue, I wouldn't be shocked if Fontas maybe supplanted Ike for a good while. He's very good for the back line has been relatively injury prone this year, and it kind of gives them a really solid third option. So overall, a good move for Sporting Kansas City. Is probably a move that they needed the most. They're rumored to still be looking to fill a defensive midfielder and a left back along with the striker, but they're being very picky on the striker, clearly, because they've said multiple times that they could just go out and buy someone if they wanted to buy someone for buying someone's sake. But they're focused on getting the right person who's going to be there for a long time if they're going to spend that type of money on somebody. So right now they're on pace to set to break their club record for goals without having a set star striker. So I think they're doing okay on that offensive end. And right now the defense is the number one thing to show up, because while they've given up multiple goals in multiple games here in a row, I think it's like six or seven now, they've also scored multiple goals in every single game except for one of those. So if they can shore up the back line and get their back line into correct form, I think they're still going to be on the right track. Regardless of getting a striker, defense has become one of the number one priorities for them. So good on them for getting this move done. We'll maybe see it announced next week or this weekend at the very earliest.
Moving on, Dan, I will be attending the Colorado Rapids versus LA Galaxy game this coming Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park as a member of the media. This will be my only LA Galaxy game at Dick's Sporting Goods Park of 2018. And unfortunately, I will not get to see or speak to Zlatan Ibrahimovic. That is because he is suspended as part of a rule that MLS put in a couple of years ago when the Steven Gerrards and the Frank Lampards, were getting called up and, selected for the MLS All-Star team, but didn't want to go because it was a midweek game and they were going to have to travel. And it was, oh, I got hurt midweek. I got hurt in the last game, but I'll be fine by the time Friday happens, but I won't be healthy for Wednesday. I'm using air quotes here, folks, since this is a podcast. And Zlatan basically said, I don't want to go because he didn't want to have to travel, all the way across the country from LA to Atlanta, play on turf, something that he and Siggy Smith and other members of the coaching staff have come out and said is not something Zlatan's very comfortable with. 36 years old, back to, 2 years in a row when she got major knee injuries, and knee injuries happen more for soccer players on turf. He did not play a couple weeks ago when the LA Galaxy got a win at New England Revolution. And I think the only other game that the Galaxy have played on turf was against the Portland Timbers up in Portland in his third, maybe fourth game in the league. And he came off the bench for 20 or 30 minutes at the absolute most. So he basically said, I didn't want to go. And then in response with this rule, he was suspended. I'm okay with having this in principle, Dan, because I do think these players should be held accountable. And this is a part of being a member of Major League Soccer. And it's something that's important that you want to show. And it's, you know, it creates an inhibitor for, you know, teams and players to want to skip out on this and really make the league look bad by not participating in one of these big spectacles, regardless of how gimmicky and, you know, dog and pony show I thought that it was, you know, 20 or 30 minutes ago in the show. That said, Zlatan's main reason for this was twofold. It's the fact that, you know, it was going to be, I think, his third game in 6 days. And if we extrapolate that out to the Rapids game on Saturday for the Galaxy, it was going to be his fourth game in 10 days, which I think is a lot to ask for any player in MLS, let alone a 36-year-old, you know, having to take a commercial flight, round trip from LAX to Atlanta and then having to play a game on turf. So if the league wants to do that, I'm totally fine. If they want to punish these players and create an inhibitor for players to skip out on it or for teams to not make their players available or, you know, for them to fake injury as an excuse to get out of it, I'm totally okay with that. But if you're going to do that, don't schedule it to where players are going to have to play 4 games in 10 days. The Galaxy had to play, you know, Thursday last week, at LAFC and El Tráfico, very emotional, very physical game. They then had to play Sunday against Orlando. You know, if you're going to do that, I'm fine with it. Don't give teams midweek games and have everybody play on Saturday. Nobody play on Sunday. No midweek games before the MLS All-Star game. No Sunday games the week before the MLS All-Star game. And then also nobody plays until Saturday. Or maybe if you want to move it back to where everybody just plays on Sunday, you know, Wednesday, Sunday, All-Star game to returning to league play. I'm totally okay with it. But, you know, all of this was entirely circumstantial. And all of the circumstance was brought about by decisions the MLS schedule makers made. And I don't fault Zlatan for saying, no, I don't want to have to play 4 games in 10 days when one of them is meaningless and is going to involve, you know, a round trip flight all the way across the country. So the league brought this situation on themselves. And really, it was kind of random in the sense that there were a bunch of teams that only had one game last week. There were teams that only played midweek. There were teams that only played on the weekend. And this was situational. It was a function of the it was a random incident of the what's the word I'm looking for? It's on the tip of my tongue here. I was talking about this with Marcelo Balboa last week. How can I not think about it now? This is a function of the random occurrence of MLS schedule congestion. I think if the league really wants to make a big deal of the All-Star game, then make it as easy as possible for these players to have it. Moving on, Dan, it is time for weekend pickums. We've got a bunch of pickums to talk about. We will start Saturday. This will be at 4 p.m. Eastern on ESPN at the aforementioned Mercedes-Benz Arena. Atlanta United will be hosting Toronto FC. Dan, who you got? Why?
I'm going to go with Atlanta on this one. I know this is they're trained. They steamroll people, and they will steamroll Toronto, who, despite looking better last week and have been playing a whole lot better with Josie Altidore in the lineup, I think they're too far back and not going to do a whole lot of favors to make up ground here. So I'm going to take Toronto. I'm going to take Atlanta in this one. I'll take it by a score of 2-1. I think it'll be closer than the standings might suggest it would be, and I think it's going to be a lot closer than most Atlanta fans might think it will be. Josie Altidore's return to Toronto has them looking a lot better, but in the end, home team, MLS, Atlanta's good. Toronto hasn't been for more than 1 week this season, so I'm going to go with Atlanta on this one.
I agree with you, Dan. Atlanta's really good. Atlanta's at home. Atlanta plays well at home. Joseph Martinez, Miguel Almiron were balling out on Wednesday. I'm going to say 2-1 to Atlanta. I say Joseph Martinez gets one goal, you know, inching closer to breaking and then up to tying, and then ultimately for me, breaking the MLS record for 27 goals in a single season. Moving on, Houston Dynamo hosting Sporting Kansas City. This will be at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Rematch of a really testy U.S. Open Cup game that you were talking about a couple minutes ago, Dan. Who you got and why?
Well, I have a hard time with this one. Sporting needs a rebound and a response. They need to be a lot better than they were defensively against FC Dallas. In a game that they should have won, they outchanced, outplayed FC Dallas for the most of it. FC Dallas' game plan to create 3 gimmicky chances against that Sporting back line, and Ike Opara failed on pretty much all of them, and Melia was probably culpable for one of them as well. They come in and they do what FC Dallas do, and they grind out wins, and they frustrate Sporting Kansas City. Houston, it's the same old Houston, not good on the road, very good at home. I think this is a more vulnerable team in the past for Houston. Sporting Kansas City are fully ready to go against this Houston team. I think they should be able to take care of them. But for the sake of MLS home teams and all that junk, I'm going to go with a 3-3 draw in this one because I'm just expecting a complete barn burner.
I'm going to agree with you on it being an absolute barn burner. You know, Albert Elise, you know, I had a couple good sniffs on Wednesday. I think both teams are going to be hungry for a win in this one. I don't see a whole lot of defense happening in this one, Dan. I'm going to say 3-2 to Houston. Expect a little bit of CONCACAFing in this one as well. Then at 11 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Plus, Portland Timbers hosting Philadelphia Union. Philadelphia Union, no Fernando Adi, but they have Diego Valeri and they have Samuel Armenteros. And then Philadelphia Union have kind of quietly been sneaking themselves back into the playoff race in the Eastern Conference. Big road game for them, Dan. Who you got and why?
I actually have Portland winning this one just because it's Portland at home. And looking at this, this is a 11 p.m. kickoff. For Philadelphia mentally, and that is a pain for these Eastern Conference teams to go out there and play super late games on the West Coast. It's a hostile atmosphere. It's tough. I'm going to go with Portland in this one. They've been playing well for the most part here. And while I like Philly, and I kind of like their dark horse chances to end up in the postseason here, I'm going to go with Portland on this one. I'll say that Portland wins this 3-1.
I agree with you. I think this is absolutely Portland's to win. You know, I think Diego Chara, you know, probably for me, one of the first, you know, names left off the ballot for the MLS All-Star game. You know, got a full week of rest this week and think he's going to be ready. You know, you've got Philly players having to travel all the way to Portland. And then you mentioned the late kickoff. I'm going to say Portland Timbers 2-0. You know, give me, you know, Diego Valeri, you know, bossing people around, nutmegging, maybe a goal off a set piece. Moving on, we'll move to Sunday, Dan. This will be our other nationally televised game of the weekend. New York Red Bulls hosting LAFC. This will be at 6 p.m. Eastern on Fox Sports 1. LAFC possibly shuffling the roster around with an Open Cup game coming up. New York Red Bulls, you know, had a rough one of it last week against the Columbus Crew. Dan, who you got and why?
I have New York Red Bulls winning this one. LAFC has been in terms of keeping up games late. They can go on and they can put on a show and they can do it. I think New York Red Bulls are going to be really pissed off after that home loss to Columbus last week. They seem to be the type of team that rebounds after a bad showing. LAFC has not shown that they can go out and just slap people around after having a couple of frustrating late leads blown. They've done it a couple times recently and given it up late. So I'm going to go with New York Red Bulls as they host LAFC. I'm going to say 2-0 to the New York Red Bulls.
I agree completely with you, Dan. I think this is all made up to get, you know, a pretty standard Red Bulls controlling 90-minute performance and 3 points on Saturday. BWP probably feeling a little bit salty after missing the PK. I think he gets a goal in this one, and I think possibly without Lorenz Simon that there isn't a whole lot they can do defensively about him and Kaku. Moving on to this coming Wednesday, folks. This will be August 8th when the MLS transfer window closes. We've got U.S. Open Cup matches. These are the semifinals. Philadelphia Union hosting the Chicago Fire. This will be at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'm not sure about the streaming details, but I assume that the clubs and U.S. Soccer will have it at some point, as well as on MLSsoccer.com. Dan, who you got and why, given, you know, both these teams are kind of fighting for a playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. Both of them have big games this coming weekend. Who do you got and why?
So I know Philly's the home team, and a lot of times U.S. Open Cup and knockout tournaments is a really safe play to go with the home team. However, there's always that feel when you watch teams through cup tournaments, you see how they perform in the games and stuff like that. There's always that feel that team has it. And for me, this year's Chicago Fire have it. They have that New York Red Bulls feel where New York Red Bulls were going through and they were taking care of business in every single game. Last year against opponents that were probably a little bit bigger of a punch for New York Red Bull. I know Philly's the host in this one, but I'm going to take Chicago in this one by a score of 2-1 because I believe in what they've been able to do. Alexander Katai has been really good signing for them. Nemanja Nikolic and Katai will be the guys who put an end to Philly's run here in the U.S. Open Cup.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan, mainly because of the travel. You know, you look at it, Philly is going to have to travel all the way to Portland and then all the way back for their home game. I think that's going to trouble them a little bit. And I also think, you know, we were talking, I can't believe we haven't brought this up at some point, but, you know, Chicago Fire made so much noise they were going to do somebody, whether it was Roman Torres or somebody else, right at the end of the spring transfer deadline. They weren't able to get anything done. It was, okay, we'll just pick up where we left off in the summer transfer window, and they haven't really done anything. So they're kind of just holding pat. You know, Nelson Rodriguez is a little bit of a curmudgeon, and let's give Veljko Panovic some credit. He and Bastian Schweinsteiger have done a lot given the resources they have and the conference that they're in and the teams that they're playing. That said, I've got to think, given the significance of this tournament to the Chicago Fire historically, given where they are in the standings and the fact that by now, you know, by then, we'll know whether or not reinforcements are coming. You know, the rumor mill has been really silent, so I'm guessing that not a whole lot is coming. So kind of two back-to-back disappointing transfer windows for the Fire, given what they were promising and what they were rumored to be in pursuit of. I think that kind of has me trending towards, well, maybe they're thinking that it's that 2018 isn't the year for them right now, but we're still two games away from winning a trophy the fans really care about, that we've historically had a good deal in a tournament, and particularly in a point where they need some good press, given what's coming for them possibly on the USL side, on the north side of Chicago, if that stadium deal's going to happen. I think they're going to prioritize US Open Cup. I think Philly is going to try and get a result in Portland, and that maybe that has them shuffling the roster, or, you know, or having some of their starters be, you know, a little bit more tired. I think Chicago Fire get the upset on the road in this one. I'm going to say 1-0 in a very, very gritty 120 minutes out in Chester, PA. Moving on, our last pick-up of the night, Dan, we've got Houston Dynamo hosting LAFC, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, U.S. Open Cup also on Wednesday. Houston will be playing at home this week. LAFC probably sending some reserves to New York Red Bulls. Who you got and why?
So I'm going to go with Houston on this one because, one, LAFC, they have the travel. They have to go to New York and then go back to Houston. That's a pain in the rear. And they play against Houston in Houston, where it's going to be hot and nasty 2 days after being in New Jersey. So Houston in this one will do it for me. I'm going to go with 2-1 here to Houston over LAFC. And I'm actually going to change my Sporting KC over Houston, or my Sporting KC Houston prediction. I'll give Sporting KC the win on this one. One, because they've shown on multiple times on this year that they can go and get results on the road. Two, Houston, I think, is actually going to go with a lesser lineup in this game. They have already done this before multiple times for the U.S. Open Cup in their tournament so far. They have sacrificed, maybe not sacrificed results, because they were able to get the results due to the opponents. But they sacrificed the first choice players, to make sure and to ensure that they were ready for full go for the knockout game in the midweek. I think Houston's going to do that again. They see this as a really big chance to get a trophy that they haven't won. I don't know if I wouldn't say ever, but in a very long time, if ever. So if I'm the Dynamo, I'm definitely holding a few guys out, maybe. Which I think without Elise and Kyoto on the field at the same time, I think their attack really loses its teeth against Sporting Kansas City. Maybe they rest Mauro Manotas and Albert Elise a little bit, considering the heavy workload and travel that they've had in recent weeks, because it seems like, as a team, they've been playing a game every 3 days for the last 2 weeks, especially those that participated in the All-Star game from that team. So I'm going to take Houston, in this game, but I'm going to change my midweek or my Saturday pick, to Sporting Kansas City getting a victory there in Houston, just because I think Houston's going to put all their, chips on the table. They're going to go all in. On LAFC on Wednesday.
Houston Dynamo's last trophy, Dan, 2007, when they won their second, when they won back-to-back MLS Cups in 2006, and 2007 over the New England Revolution. So it's been over a decade since Houston.
With my San Jose Earthquakes.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay, yeah.
That's a painful spot.
Okay. Yes, but in any case, I was just correcting in terms of, you know, when was the last. Point is, it's been a while since Houston's won a trophy. I'm gonna retweet and favorite everything that you said, Dan. I think this is Houston's absolutely to win. I think the humidity is gonna be a factor, and I think, you know, certainly that front four attacking is gonna be really crazy. I think this potentially could be more bonkers than that LAFC Portland game in terms of the play on the field, not in terms of words that were potentially said to Adama Diomande reportedly or not. score in terms of, you know, Portland contesting it because of player eligibility, but just in terms of how back and forth that game was and goals and things being called offsides and just it being wall-to-wall action from minute 1 to minute 90, I think this could very well be that. I think Houston's going to come out and end up winning it overall. That is it for all the content we have tonight, Dan. It is time for last words. Where can people find you on the Twitter machine, and what are you brooding on this day?
So you can find me on the Twitter machine, @SperryDaniel. I actually don't have anything like that's making me mad, or I don't have anything to rant about. I just wanted to say, last Thursday we didn't get to do a pod, and I was out covering the U.S. Women's National Team in the Tournament of Nations. It was a doubleheader at Children's Mercy Park here in Kansas City. We got to see Australia and Brazil in the early match, and then U.S. played Japan in the second match, where the U.S. Totally ran riot over a surprisingly weak Japan team that didn't look very good. The only women's soccer that I've watched at a professional level was an NWSL game back in 2014. The only reason I went was because Megan Rapinoe and Hope Solo were there. And we got into funsies with Hope Solo, which is a story for another day. But she did flip us off in the supporter section, which is a lot of fun.
Give it okay.
Like I said, story for another day, but that's what happened. So that's like my only experience with women's soccer, and it was played on turf. It was a very back and forth game. It was really entertaining, and I was really impressed. So we come back, and I sit there, and we are watching this Australia-Brazil game. And I think it is one of the ugliest games of soccer that I have seen. Brazil looked a lot slower than I expected them to be, considering from what I've seen from them in the past from Women's World Cups and other tournaments and such. So I was disappointed kind of in what I'd seen from Brazil in that. I was impressed. Australia totally FC Dallas the game. They went in there and tried to make Brazil's beautiful technical play ugly, and kind of muck it up, and then trying to hit them on the counter and hit on set pieces. And they did exactly that. They messed with the set piece defense of Brazil, getting two goals off corner kicks, one that were harmless. One ended up being an own goal. The other one, was a header that rebounded and pinged around like four people. And then, one girl headed it in. So the game itself was a snooze fest, but it was really, I was kind of disappointed in the quality of the game just in general, because it was just kind of a slugfest. There was probably 20 fouls between the two teams. It was very choppy. There was no rhythm, no flow to the game. And then the U.S. Women's National Team came out there. And I think it's just watching that game against Japan and taking the whole night into account, it is just incredible how far superior the U.S. Women's National Team is to a lot of these women's national teams around the world. It was the first time I've seen the full women's national team together in person, and I was completely blown away. Tobin Heath is incredible down the wing. I don't dabble in a whole lot of women's soccer, and I don't watch a lot of NWSL. We don't talk about it a whole lot on the podcast, outside of the very, very big things that happen. But I do have to give them credit, because technically they were very good in that game. Tactically, I loved the setup from Jill Ellis on that, and I thought she set them up pretty well. I got to see some really good tactical nuances from them. And then on top of that, Tobin Heath was incredible. Alex Morgan had a hat trick. Megan Rapinoe pulled all the strings in the midfield, and it was just a really impressive showing from that women's national team. I know they're playing right now against Brazil in the final match of that Tournament of Nations, but this women's national team is very, very good. I am really excited for the Women's World Cup coming up next year. It is going to be a lot of fun. There's a lot of talent on that U.S. women's national team system. It's incredible, because a lot of the girls, there's a potential that some of the girls that did not play here in Kansas City may not even make the World Cup roster, just because of how deep this team is. So incredibly blown away by the women's national team. They did a great job. You know, they came in and they talked a whole lot after the game about how great Kansas City was, and what a great venue, that they loved coming to Children's Mercy Park, and the crowd was awesome. There's a really good atmosphere, sold out crowd, 19,000 people there. But I think for me, the biggest thing that I took away was their showing here in Kansas City, and they really showed some very, very good soccer and some very impressive far superior from everything from technical to the athleticism of them as well. Was just completely superior on the night. So it was a really cool experience. Had to talk about it. If you haven't gotten in and gone to go see a women's soccer game, if you're close to an NWSL market, if you are close to the U.S. women's national team coming into town, I highly encourage you to go see it. Go pay attention to it if that is not normally your thing. Because for someone like me, who it wasn't normally my thing, really kind of blew me away, and really kind of has definitely drawn my intrigue a lot more to the NWSL and to women's soccer in general. Not outside of every 4 years for the Women's World Cup, but more of a yearly basis and a weekly basis of paying attention to see what happens in the NWSL, see the goals, see how they're playing. And kind of keep up with how they're doing elsewhere around the world, as there's a few that play outside of the U.S. So if you haven't gotten into it, go get into it. It is entirely worth your while, and it is just as entertaining as any men's soccer you'll ever see.
Fun stuff, Dan. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Check out all of our content all season long at LastWordOnSoccer.com. You can follow us across all social media platforms at LastWordSC. If you want to find the podcast anywhere than where you're listening to us right now, just search for us wherever you get your podcasts. Find us by searching for LWOS Radio, and you can find a lot of other really good audio content that Last Word on Sports puts out. Thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of Major League Soccer, the United Soccer League, and U.S. Soccer in general. Get your custom scarves for your group, yourself, or your team at roughneckscarves.com. My last word for this one, Dan, one of my really good friends here in Rapids land, Rapids Rabbi Mark Goodman, is moving to Pittsburgh for personal reasons that I won't go into detail. But in any case, this coming Saturday is his second to last Rapids home game. His final one will be next week when they play your San Jose Earthquakes. And I'm really, really sad about this. We're doing a testimonial kick around. He's a little bit older now and doesn't really have the full energy for a testimonial game. And since it's his testimonial game, I guess he gets to set the rules. So we're having a testimonial, what's probably going to end up being a testimonial 5v2 and then water cooler talk. And then we're also doing a meet and greet as part of Holding the High Line, my Rapids podcast, before the game as well. I'm really, really sad to see him go. He's a really good follow, and if you are in the Pittsburgh area, he is definitely going to be checking out the Pittsburgh Riverhounds and soccer throughout the state of Pennsylvania, so definitely check him out. I'm sad to see him, but Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and Pittsburgh in particular are getting a really, really good person in the soccer internet space, and someone who I've interacted with and had a really fun time knowing. That does it for us, folks. We will see you next week.